Hello, everyone. Again, I apologize for being late with this episode. Unfortunately, I've been seriously ill with a respiratory virus. Not COVID, thankfully, but one that had very similar symptoms. And it took a while before I could finish a sentence without coughing. There's a couple of other ongoing issues in my life right now that have also kind of interfered with the production schedule, but I'm hoping to get things back on track soon. I do plan on getting at least one more episode out this month, and then take a break around Christmas and New Year's. And after that, I will try to get this podcast back on a bi-monthly schedule. But as always, I really appreciate everybody's patience and support at this time. So with that, I'll just jump right into it. Catherine finally gave birth to a new heir to the French throne, named Francois after her father-in-law. From there, she kept having children, and this ensured her political survival. However, I think that even outside the need to preserve her future at the French court, Catherine wanted to be a mother. In her memoirs, her daughter Marguerite described Catherine as a mother who doted on all her children and was always ready to sacrifice her own repose, nay, even her life, for their happiness. Indeed, Catherine went above and beyond most royal mothers, making sure they were well tended to and that they ate a diet she herself prescribed even when she was away. She was apparently also personally strict, at least to her daughter Marguerite, or Margot, who in her memoirs wrote, "It is not only that I dare not open a conversation with her, but when she looks at me, I almost die of fright in case I have done something to displease her." But perhaps that was only Margot's experience, since she was also the problem child out of Catherine's brood. About Margot, Catherine frankly wrote in one letter, "I see that God has left me this creature for the punishment of my sins through the affliction she gives me. She is my curse in this world." But regardless of such sour feelings towards this one child, Catherine was clearly a loving mother, probably by any standards, not just those of 16th century royalty. One of the artifacts she left posterity is a prayer book, which carries a painting of Louis, Victoire, and Jean, the three children of hers who died in infancy. Luckily, Catherine's position as queen was secured just in time, because her number one benefactor, King Francois, was entering his final days. Toward the end of January 1548, King Henry VIII of England had died and was succeeded by the son he desperately wanted, who became King Edward VI. The court celebrated, since they long thought of Henry VIII as France's implacable enemy, especially after he managed to capture the city of Boulogne on the English Channel during an invasion. However, Francois was unnerved. He long thought of Henry VIII as his kindred spirit, so the fear that they could die in the same year gripped him. Francois was already ill, only able to go on hunting trips while carried in a litter. It was on the way back to Paris to attend a memorial service for Henry VIII that Francois was suddenly struck down by a severe fever, stopping at the royal chateau in the town of Rambouillet. There, he gradually lost his ability to get up from his bed and speak until, on March 31st, he followed Henry VIII to the grave. Historians suspect, given Francois's rather risque lifestyle, that he died from either gonorrhea or syphilis. Now, Henri II and Catherine were King and Queen of France. At Francois's funeral, Catherine genuinely wept, having lost a man that she may very well have come to see not just as her benefactor, but as the sort of father figure she never really had. While Francois had been content playing a balancing act between the various factions and dynasties at the royal court, Henri immediately cleaned house. Henri particularly had a grudge against his father's mistress, Anne d'Étampes. She was barred from returning to court, and even briefly imprisoned, without royal protection, her husband, who had married her at the king's behest to provide a layer of respectability to their affair, sued her, claiming she had embezzled some of his land revenues. In the end, Anne de Tomp had to retire from public life, dedicating herself to charitable works. If Diane de Poitiers took this as a warning about how fragile a mistress's position was, no matter how high she rose, there's no sign. Henri would also give the cold shoulder to anyone suspected of reformist or Protestant sympathies. Francois's beloved sister Marguerite de Navarre appeared less in court. So did the king's cousins, the Bourbons, whom we'll learn more about soon. Instead, the king invited back Anne de Montmorency, who had retired from court after losing King Francois's favor. Also, Henri favored a new family, the Guises. The Guises were a branch of the ruling family of the Duchy of Lorraine on France's eastern border. At the start of the 16th century, the family migrated to some lands in northern France that they owned. The family patriarch Claude was commended for his fighting during the Italian Wars and granted the title of Duke of Guise, from which the family took its name. Within just a generation, the family had become part of France's aristocratic and clerical elite, with Claude's daughter Marie even marrying King James V of Scotland. Of course, in the world of the French aristocracy, where pedigree was almost everything, it helped that the Guises were, as part of a family ruling an independent duchy, almost as good as royalty. But the Dukes of Lorraine, and thus the Guises themselves, had a claim to be directly descended from none other than Charlemagne. It's a dubious claim, neither proven nor disproven by modern genealogists and historians, but it was a claim that was widely believed at the time nonetheless, and that would eventually help make the Guises seem to be a threat to the throne itself. That was in the future, though. For now, the Guises formed a new power block on which Henri rested his reign, one that was both anti-imperial and also rigidly anti-Protestant. When it came to his oppression of the Huguenots, Henri wasn't entirely charting a new course. Persecutions had been growing since the Night of the Placards, but in the final years of King Francois's reign, the anti-Protestant campaign had been escalated. With the explicit support of the king, the regional parliaments of France put Huguenots on trial, imprisoning them or even burning them. As might be expected, the campaign was especially hard in the south. At the major port city of La Rochelle, 118 people were arrested, 25 of whom were burned alive. Likewise, the Parliament of Provence had over 60 people killed and executed after one campaign of persecution. The worst episode of persecution to take place under King Francois also happened in Provence on April of 1525. Members of the Waldensian movement, a religious sect that had existed since the 12th century and had been long deemed heretical by the Catholic Church, were massacred at the behest of local officials and with King Francois's approval. Perhaps up to 2,700 people were killed, and 600 more were made into galley slaves. The Baron of Opade, the chief architect of the massacre, was congratulated by King Francois and granted a noble title in the Papal States by the Pope. After Henri II came to the throne, Opade actually was brought to trial, mainly on allegations that he exploited the massacre in order to confiscate land from a local noblewoman. Although as a result of the charges, he was imprisoned for 2 years, he was eventually exonerated and allowed to resume his old office as first president of the Parliament of Provence. At the very least, in his own reign, Henri did make the machinery of persecution more formal and centralized. Henri established a special judicial office to try cases of heresy, given the ominous name the Burning Chamber by Protestants, and he asked the papacy to establish the French Inquisition. How Catherine felt about all this is a matter of debate. Although there is evidence that she did not share her husband's animosity toward the Huguenots. Indeed, there is one instance during Henri's reign where she intervened personally to get a Huguenot woman released from prison. Overall, Catherine wasn't completely left out in the cold, despite her husband's relationship with Diane de Poitiers. Once her husband became king, she was granted estates and revenues as was suitable for a new queen, and was allowed to fully claim some property and wealth from the estates of her mother, who was, after all, a French noblewoman. However, Diane de Poitiers was also elevated. She was given the title of Duchess of Valentinois, the highest title in the French aristocratic hierarchy that Henri could give her. The new title also gave her the right to walk alongside princesses of royal rank during Catherine's own coronation as queen. Diane also tended to Catherine personally whenever she fell ill or when she was in labor. The three formed an odd three-way household. We know Catherine's real feelings about the woman she called her husband's whore. In another letter to her daughter Elizabeth later in life, Catherine admitted, "I loved him so much, I was always afraid." Personally, I'd interpret this to mean that Catherine put up with Diane because she was afraid she could lose what esteem her husband had for her. While we don't know how much political influence Diane had over Henri II, and she probably didn't have that much type of influence, even though ambassadors love to suggest otherwise. He certainly did spend a great deal of time in her presence. According to an ambassador from Ferrara, Henri spent about one-third of each day in Diane's company and would share with her all the important business of state. No wonder Catherine must have resented Diane. Even so, when Henri struck up an affair with the Scottish woman Janet Stuart, the governess who accompanied Mary Queen of Scots to France, Catherine and Diane closed ranks and managed to get Janet sent back to Scotland. Neither wanted a new competitor to disrupt the equilibrium they had in Henri's life. And it seems that neither Catherine nor Diane had that much political influence over Henri, at least compared to Anne de Montmorency, who was more or less Henri's unofficial prime minister. Luckily for Diane and Catherine, Henri was not nearly as much of a Lothario as his father, nor was he as smart or culturally curious. Henri never shared his father's appreciation for art and literature, although he did have his own interest in music and architecture. Still, under Henri, the expenditures spent on patronage and court entertainments were cut. Since she was merely the queen consort, there's only so much Catherine could spend on artists and writers and scholars. Although she did apparently help keep some artists from Francois's court employed in France, like the painter and sculptor Francesco Primaticcio. During these years, Catherine's fascination with astrology and the occult also grew, which would, depending on your point of view, either taint or delightfully embellish her historical reputation. While Catherine patroned several astrologers, she learned enough mathematics and astronomy that she could make her own star charts. In her employ, she had the famous Nostradamus, the author of so many alleged prophecies that go up to our own era. But she also had two notorious magicians from Florence, Tommaso and Cosimo Ruggieri. Cosimo had a particularly morbid reputation. It was whispered that he kept the decapitated head of a Jewish baby that would tell him secrets when he performed the rite rituals. Catherine herself believed that she had a second sight. In her memoirs, Margot claimed that she herself witnessed her mother predicting Henri's death and how he would die in a dream. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. For now, let's meet a surrogate member of Catherine's growing family, Mary Stuart, the oft-romanticized Queen of Scots. Her father, King James V, died young in 1542, possibly from cholera, although some have speculated he was pushed over the brink by news of a disastrous battle against the English. Henry VIII, who was still alive at the time, planned to conquer Scotland and abduct the infant Mary. Since she was James's only child and heir, the infant was the rightful Queen of Scotland. By forcing the child to wed his own son Edward, the kingdoms of Scotland and England would finally be united. This was darkly called England's rough wooing. However, Mary's mother, the Queen Regent of Scotland, Marie de Guise, managed to smuggle Mary off on a ship to France. Once the Scottish Queen was safe at the French royal court, in 1549, Henry II declared war on England, retaking Boulogne. While Mary was a useful political pawn, Henry did dote on her as if she were his own daughter. She would grow into an unusually tall and attractive teenager who took to her education easily, although her tutors were tasked to wean Mary off her Scottish heritage, which seemed quasi-barbaric to the elites of France. For example, her first language throughout most of her life would not be her native Scots, which she spoke when she first arrived in France as a small child. Instead, it would become French. By 1553, when Mary was just 10 years old, her power on the European diplomatic chessboard soared. When King Edward died, there was an ill-fated coup by militant Protestants to put his cousin Jane Grey on the throne. The coup failed, and instead England came to be ruled by Edward's staunchly Catholic half-sister, Mary Tudor. She had no children, and was unlikely to have any, because she was in her late 30s. She did have a sister, Elizabeth, but because of Henry VIII's complicated marital history, in the eyes of the Catholic Church, Elizabeth was illegitimate. As far as the Pope and the Catholic heads of state of Europe were concerned, this made Mary Stuart, who was Henry VIII's great niece, Mary Tudor's rightful heir. That's a lot of Marys, I know. This made Mary Stuart too valuable a resource for the French monarchy to leave in the hands of the Scottish. So the French entered negotiations that Mary Stuart would not just be the head of an allied nation seeking refuge within their borders. Instead, they entered negotiations to betroth Mary to the Dauphin Francois. In the official version of the treaty, Henry II and the Scottish ambassadors agreed that the Crown of Scotland and any claim to England would be unified with the Crown of France in the event that Francois and Mary had a male heir. If Mary died without a child, however, then the Crown of Scotland would go to Mary's nearest blood relation, or to a daughter, if Mary and Francois had one. But behind the scenes, Henry had Mary sign another treaty unknown to any of the Scottish diplomats. In this one, if Mary died even without children, then the Scottish crown and any claims to the English throne would actually go to Francois and his descendants. It's hard to fault Mary for signing off on such a one-sided treaty. After all, why would the man she saw as her father, whose son would be her husband, ever not have her best interests at heart? With English affairs taken care of, at least for a little while, Henry reignited the Italian Wars in 1552. Apparently this wasn't just about French pride or even Milan, but Henry burned for personal revenge against Charles V for holding himself and his brother hostages all those years ago. On the pretext that he was helping defend the liberty of several German Protestant princes against the Holy Roman Empire, never mind that Henry was having Protestants burned to death in his own domains, Henry declared war on Charles V. This would prove to be Catherine's first time in the spotlight. While she had assumed political responsibilities while her husband was off on campaign before, Now she was allowed to serve as a regent, but only a regent who presided over a council of five along with Montmorency. It was apparently during their heated debates over policy that Catherine forged her dislike of Montmorency, if she didn't come to dislike the man before. But it was Catherine, not Montmorency, or Diane for that matter, who personally appeared before the Parliament of Paris, begging that they vote to grant their king more funds for his war. In her speech, during which she reportedly wept, she said, "My dear lords, I am come to you because the blood of France is also my blood. We know that during times of war, many sacrifices have to be made, and that for some cities the cost of war is so great that it is almost unbearable. However, I would not be presenting myself to you if I, and your lord, my king, did not need you in this difficult time. I do not doubt the confidence, trust, and affection you have for your king, my lord, and husband." She received the full 300,000 crowns she asked for. It was a proud political debut, and she must have known it was such. She even boasted to her cousin Cosimo de' Medici, Duke of Florence, that her husband had trusted her with such a crucial task. Unfortunately, in the end, the investment did not entirely pay off. By 1559, Henri was no longer even fighting Charles V. Perhaps dogged by the depression that seemed to plague his Spanish ancestors. In 1555, Charles V had abdicated and retired to an isolated monastery in Spain, leaving Austria to his brother Ferdinand, and Spain and its territories in Italy, the Netherlands, and the Americas to his son Philip. Philip eventually kept on with the Italian wars along with his wife, who happened to be Queen Mary Tudor, and who dragged England back into war, despite the opposition of England's Parliament. By 1559, Henri was forced to the negotiating table. The resulting Treaty of Cateau-Cambrésis saw Henri give up all claims to Milan and Naples in exchange for some territory in what is now northeastern France. To seal the deal, the recently widowed King Philip was to marry Henri's daughter Elizabeth. The treaty also saw France receive Calais, England's last crumb of territory in continental Europe. This was supposed to be only a temporary transfer of the territory, but I suspect both the French and the English envoys realized that it would prove to be permanent. It was a historic victory for France, at least in hindsight, seeing France finally wipe away the last remnant of what was once England's stranglehold on the country. But the mood at the French court about the treaty was dour. France had fought this series of wars for generations, and all they had to show for it was the old status quo, except for a slight expansion of their northeastern border, while the Habsburgs of Spain and Austria remained as much a threat as ever. Still, after the bitterness over defeat had passed, I suspect for Henri things were looking up. Queen Mary of England had died in despair over losing Calais and her disastrous marriage to Philip, which was not unlike Catherine's own fate in marrying a man she loved who did not love her in return. The bastard heretic Elizabeth was now Queen of England, and Henri had the rightful monarch of England and Scotland right in his own court. Actually, she was even married to his own son and heir. It was about time the game of dynastic marriage and royal succession worked out in favor of someone who wasn't a Habsburg. So perhaps this bit of hope in the horizon was on Henri's mind as he fought in a joust on June 30th to celebrate the peace treaty and the betrothal between Elizabeth and Philip. That is, his daughter Elizabeth and Philip, not Queen Elizabeth of England. His wife had a dream he would be badly injured at the joust, but Henri probably laughed off such concerns. After all, Catherine had clearly been spending too much time in the company of sorcerers and astrologers. And Henri had beaten two seasoned military veterans, the Duke of Guise and the Duke of Namur, at the joust. He had been riding a horse named Malheureux, which means unfortunate, but this was a joke or perhaps a reverse blessing of sorts, like wishing an actor to break a leg during a performance. Trusting his luck, and despite his growing exhaustion, Henri decided on just one more joust to round out the day. Henri was proudly sporting the colors of his mistress, Diane de Poitiers, while Catherine anxiously watched from the sides. His opponent would be the Count of Montgomery, a Scottish nobleman who served as the captain of the king's Scottish bodyguard. Montgomery nearly knocked Henri off his horse. Catherine got up again and asked Henri to retire from the competition. Even Montgomery asked the king to let him step away. Henri got annoyed, however, and commanded Montgomery to come at him again. This time, the king did fall. And when the worried spectators found him, he had a long piece of wood broken off from Montgomery's spear, sticking out of the visor of his helmet. Thank you for listening, and buona notte.